Bonjour à tous, merci d'être venus au CIMATINAG pour cette première conférence du deuxième jour des Utopiades, qui sera une rencontre avec Emma Newman. Emma Newman est une auteure britannique qui vient de sortir son premier, dont un des premiers livres vient d'être sorti, qui s'appelle Planet Fog, qui est un space opéra, un planet opéra, dont on va vous parler dans quelques minutes. Il y aura quelques brochures qui circuleront dans le public, mais tout d'abord, j'avais envie de vous poser une question. Pourquoi la science-fiction? Qu'est-ce que la science-fiction pour vous?
So first of all, I'm sorry I didn't say hello. I was going, I can hear a different voice in the earphones. My brain was getting a little bit confused, so apologies. So why science fiction? For me, science fiction has always been my favorite genre. When I was about 8 years old, I found a book in Camborne Library in Cornwall, which was called Trillions by Nicholas Fiske. And it was the first proper science fiction that I had read. And I just couldn't go back. I couldn't go back to books which were set in the normal world. And throughout my teens, science fiction was really all that I read. I had a really big row with my English teacher when I was about 17. We'd been told that we had to go and read the classics over the summer holidays. And I went back and told him about The Time Machine and The Invisible Man and War of the Worlds and Prelude to Foundation. And he was saying, no, the classics. And I was like, no, these are the classics. What are you talking about? We had this big fight about how important science fiction is in our consciousness. And for me, science fiction is the perfect lens through which we can examine life now, because we are always writing about life now, even if it's set in the future. It's, for me, one of the most creative ways to examine the way that we live and what we could do and what we could be in the future at the same time.
Et comment vous est venu l'envie d'écrire?
I started writing when I was 4, according to my grandmother, and it's her favorite story about me, that she saw me at the table working very hard and she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm writing a story, Nana. And it was rubbish, I'm sure. I wrote loads of rubbish all the way through my childhood and all the way through my teens. It was just something that I always did. But funnily enough, the first books that I had published were not science fiction. And to this day, I don't know why another story came out first, and that's urban fantasy. But then I realized I was afraid to write science fiction because it was my first love and my purest love in genre, and I didn't want to get it wrong. And there is no right or wrong in writing, but I think I just didn't feel ready or brave enough to write something in a genre that was that important to me. And then when I always knew that I wanted to write about somebody who suffers from the particular disorder that my protagonist does in Planet Four. And then various things just fell into place and I realized that this had to be science fiction. It was definitely the right setting for the story that I wanted to tell. And then I just had to take a deep breath and be brave and jump in.
Et au niveau de vos influences, quelles sont vos influences qui vous ont poussé à écrire?
Everything. When people ask about what influences me, when they talk about my writing, I always think, do they mean which books? But for me, it's every single thing that I have consumed, everything I've done in my life. It's like my entire life is just making a great big compost heap, in which I just throw everything, all of the films, all of the books, in all genres, and that they all kind of mulch down and rot in my head. And then the things that I write are the mushrooms that grow out of that. So the influences I have when I write science fiction don't just come from science fiction. And a lot of it comes from technology, present-day technology developments, daydreams, and a lot of frustration. A lot of anger. I'm always angry. I'm like the Hulk. I'm always angry. And I find that the best way to deal with my rage at everything is to write books. And so there's a lot of my anger and frustration and despair with current society that goes into my novels as well, whether that's urban fantasy or science fiction. It all goes in there somewhere.
Vous écrivez aussi bien des romans que des nouvelles. Quel genre vous préférez? Est-ce que écrire un roman ou une nouvelle est beaucoup plus simple?
I think they're different. I see. Thank you. I see short stories like having wild affairs, where you can fall in love with an idea and that it can be very short and intense and passionate. Whereas writing a novel is like getting married, and that there has to be a long-term commitment and a lot of thought and a lot of work that goes into a novel. And there is something that I really enjoy about that. I really enjoy being inside a place for a longer time and having something that I'm always thinking about all the time, whatever I'm doing, wherever I'm going. It's always kind of cooking at the back of my head, and I really love that about writing a novel. But with a short story, there's a greater freedom to explore ideas that you couldn't sustain in a novel. So for me, they're just kind of like different types of relationship and different types of conversation almost. There can be, like, for example, if when you meet somebody really interesting when you're traveling somewhere, and you can have a really wonderful meeting, a moment of meeting somebody, and there's a rapid exchange and it's exciting, that feels like a short story. Whereas with a novel, they feel more like a long friendship where you can go deep, where you can stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning and really talk about the important things. And that kind of depth of exploration is what I enjoy in novels.
Vous avez écrit, on trouve un de vos textes dans l'anthologie des Utopiennes qui reprend une figure mythique de la littérature britannique, qui est Sherlock Holmes, mais avec un point de vue très différent, très féminin, dans un monde projeté dans un futur avec des nouvelles technologies, sans dévoiler un seul moment de l'histoire en elle-même. D'où vous est venue cette idée?
I was commissioned to write a story. I can suddenly hear French in my... So I was commissioned to write a story for an anthology called 221 Baker Streets. And the editor wanted to make a collection which had Sherlock Holmes at the heart, but lots and lots and lots and lots of different versions. Everyone was free to play with him in whatever way they chose. And for me, I mean... Everyone knows Sherlock Holmes. Everyone loves Sherlock Holmes, it seems. And it's been done so many times and explored in so many ways. And I grew up watching like three different interpretations of Sherlock Holmes on television. And I'd read the stories. And I was thinking, what could I do that's different? What is a new angle? And I was thinking about Mrs. Hudson and how awful Sherlock Holmes is to her. And I was thinking, why does she put up with that horrible man? It really puzzled me. And so then there was suddenly the story, why does she put up with this? Because if I was that landlady, I'd be like, no, you can't shoot holes in the wall. You can't do all of these crazy things. Get out and I'll have a good tenant in my rooms. So I wanted to explore what the motivation was for her to keep him, even though he is a terrible tenant. And so that's what the story explores. And the rest of it was just fun. It was just fun to gender flip Watson. It's such an easy thing to do, gender flipping, that was almost like an afterthought. But it was, yes, it was mostly, and also to put Mrs. Hudson front and center, that there was definitely an element of feminism there, that, you know, there are so many stories in which all of the women are in the background and are just parts of the machine that turns around the men. And I wanted to put her front and center for a change and say, here you go, Mrs. Hudson, you have a moment in the spotlight.
On retrouve un personnage principal dans Planète Fauve, dont on va parler dans quelques instants, qui est aussi une femme, la place des femmes dans vos histoires. Est-ce que c'est une importance, c'est une prédominance d'avoir des personnages féminins qui soient au centre de vos histoires?
Not necessarily. I'm trying to remember. One of the reasons I made Ren a woman was because I wanted to have an engineer, and I have many friends, many female friends who work in engineering and physics and science, and we have many conversations about how women are not represented in those fields in the real world. And I wanted to have a utopian element in my stories, that somebody is an engineer and nobody bats an eyelid and is a woman. Whoa, revolutionary. And so that would be great. But there was nothing, there were certain elements of her life that I wanted to explore that fit better with a female character. But in After Atlas, the second novel, the lead character is a man. So, and in my urban fantasy stories, there are four main characters, only one of which is a woman. So I don't feel that I have to rebalance the entirety of literature and media in my work. It's whether there is something about that character which necessitates that gender. In the third science fiction novel that I literally finished checking the page proofs yesterday before I flew here, the lead character is a woman, and that's very important for the character, because I wanted to look at postnatal depression. So it's obviously quite important to have a female character to look at that.
Vous avez mentionné le nom de Ren, le personnage principal de Planetfall. Comment on pourrait décrire l'univers de Planetfall sans trop dévoiler au public? Parce que c'est un roman qui a du suspense, qui tient sur des éléments du secret.
Yeah, there are so many secrets within this novel that it's very difficult, isn't it, for us to talk about. In terms of the world, the novel focuses on a colony that's been established on a distant planet, and Ren, the protagonist, is the colony's 3D printing engineer. So she runs and maintains all of the 3D printing units, but she's also responsible for building the colony, which uses a lot of that technology. She's also very good at synthetic biology, which is one of the things that I wanted to explore in that world. So it's set in the future, but all of the technology within that world is an extrapolation from what exists now. So there's nothing in there that I would consider bordering on magical in terms of it being so distant from what we have now. Everything is either faster or better versions of what we have now, or a more creative use of what we have now. But a lot of the technology, especially in the buildings that they live in the colony, is technology that's being explored now. It's just not widely talked about. And I went to the Clark Awards 2 or 3 years ago, I'm terrible at keeping track of when I did what, but there was a talk by a scientist there called Rachel Armstrong, who was incredibly interesting, and she talked about so many ideas that went into the book. She just lit my mind on fire, talking about technology involving protocells, where you can make a special kind of dirt effectively that goes inside the walls of the house so that you can process waste without the need for kind of expensive plumbing and environmentally unfriendly practices. All kinds of really, really interesting ideas. And so, yeah, the world has a foundation of real technology. And for me, that's where science fiction is the most exciting. I mean, obviously, I'm reading space opera at the moment, written by a friend of mine, and I love space opera and, you know, whizzing around in spaceships and doing crazy things. And it's amazing, and I love it. But where science fiction really genuinely, intensely excites me is the examination of where technology could go and how that intersects with the human experience and how that changes us and what it gives us. That's what I like the most.
Planetfall parle aussi de Dieu, d'une recherche de Dieu, de déterminisme plus ou moins sous texte. D'où est venue l'idée justement de... D'où est venue l'idée de cet univers et de cette recherche divine? Et est-ce que c'était naturel comme processus, ou est-ce que c'est venu en créant l'univers en tant que tel?
It actually was a little bit of grit left in my mind from an interview I overheard years ago when I was at my friend's house. And it was on BBC Radio 4, and it was an interview with a physicist. And this physicist was talking about how his study of the universe brings him closer to God. And I literally stopped in the middle of the kitchen and went, "What?" at the radio. And I was so shocked, because in all of the narratives that I've been exposed to, religion and science are dealt with very separately. And it really fascinated me to listen to somebody who was a very, very accomplished scientist talking about the depth of his faith. And that just stuck with me. I think Neil Gaiman, in a talk I went to years ago, talked about where stories come from, that these bits of grit stick in your mind, and then over time, a pearl forms around them. And that was the bit of grit that explored that whole idea of, could I create realistic characters who were both religious and scientists? It was almost like a challenge to myself. And also to see if I could have a protagonist who had faith and was also very, very, very scientific in the way she thought, whether that I could have that mind of hers support both. It was kind of a curiosity of my own as to how somebody like that could work, because I don't have any faith whatsoever. And so it was interesting to me to create something, to create people that have that.
Eh bien, en face de cette colonie qui est à la recherche de Dieu, il y a justement cette cité de Dieu qui est un peu le pendant inverse de la colonie hyper technologique. Comment vous est venue cette idée d'une cité organique, vivante, qui saigne, et comment on l'a construit en fait? Comment on arrive à la construire? Est-ce que ça a été difficile de l'imaginer? Est-ce que c'est juste scénaristique, un élément de décor, ou c'était un peu plus que ça?
I would tell you the very specific thing that led to that as an idea, but it would spoil the entire book. So when we're not in front of an audience, I will tell you. But there was one particular idea that I discovered in a random documentary many years ago, and that came out in the purpose of that place. As for it being an organic structure, I was already playing around with lots of ideas of using synthetic biology to build structures. And I think it was a combination of thinking about that kind of technology, thinking about the purpose of the city, which I can't say because spoilers, but also there's an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, which is very old now, and I think it's called Tin Man, where there's a living biological spaceship that a very strong telepath forms a relationship with, and I really liked the idea of that. I really liked the idea of having structures that are living, and this is not a new idea in science fiction. There are lots of people who have played with the ideas of growing cities, because it kind of makes sense. Instead of pouring lots of concrete that makes loads and loads of carbon and is very damaging, instead growing structures, if you could find a way to do that, would be very logical. It was a confluence of lots of different ideas. As for whether it was difficult, no, it was just there. It was weird. It was almost like when I was writing the novel, I was going to a place that already existed in my mind, and I just had to describe it. And I think it's always also easier when you're talking about a location that is biological, because you already have things that you can draw upon, other metaphors and descriptions which come naturally.
Votre personnage reine, le personnage principal, en plus d'être une scientifique qui à la fois souffre d'une maladie assez particulière.
Yes.
Est-ce que ça a été difficile de se mettre dans la tête de quelqu'un qui souffre d'un handicap, qui expérimente quelque chose qu'elle doit plus ou moins taire, dont elle n'a pas envie de parler, de partager avec une communauté?
Yeah, she's a very complex character, and that is challenging to write. One of the reasons, there are many reasons why I wanted to write her, but one of them was a conscious decision to have a protagonist who suffers from a severe mental illness. And one of the reasons was that I don't believe we have enough of them in media, and in particular, we don't have enough characters who suffer from mental illness and yet are also brilliant, capable, important in their communities, and do lots of great things, because half of my friends fall into that category. Half of my friends suffer from mental illness and yet have the most amazing lives and do the most incredible things. And I also suffer from generalized anxiety disorder, and I have decided to be public about that because I want us to have more dialogue in society about not only experiencing these disorders, but also how we navigate life despite them. And so when it came to writing Wren, I had, if you imagine a Venn diagram of my anxiety disorder and Wren's, there is an overlap in the middle. And in that overlap, I could draw upon experiences. And I've had people contact me saying I had to put the book down and walk away because it was such a realistic depiction of a panic attack at one point and anxious thinking. And that was stuff that I wrote from my own experience that was realistic. The rest of her disorder, I was very nervous about writing about it because I wanted to do it well. I didn't want to sensationalize it. I wanted to approach it sensitively and with respect to the people who have this in their real lives. And so there was a huge amount of research that I did. And also, I think there are elements, I think there are some common building blocks in that disorder and mine that I could kind of examine the roots of that disorder and say, actually, I can imagine doing that myself. I can see myself being three or four steps away from that. And when you have that moment of understanding, that can really help when you're writing a character like that. But yeah, it was a lot of going to the source, finding people, talking about it themselves. There are a lot of very dry clinical papers that you can read about this kind of disorder, and it's not the same as seeing and hearing and reading first-person accounts of it.
Est-ce que ça a été difficile de trouver ces témoignages, du coup? Est-ce que ça a demandé beaucoup de recherche ou
Well, the internet is a wonderful thing, and so thankfully there's a lot of material out there, and it's a matter of sifting through it, because there are some areas of television that have explored it, but they always have their own narrative, and they always have their own way of presenting mental illnesses that you have to navigate and say, they want me to feel this at this point in the program. Is that an artifact of the way that they are presenting this disorder, or is this what it is really like? And so it's kind of like a process of triangulation, of finding lots of different places and looking for the common elements and saying, this is what feels authentic. I met somebody at an event 2 or 3 months ago who had read it and said that his mother suffers from that disorder, and that it was spot on. And he said it was incredibly difficult to read, but incredibly cathartic as well, because he felt that he could understand. So that was a huge relief. And that's the thing, because whenever you write about anything which is distressing, there are people in the real world who could read it who have experienced that, and you have to do it well. You have to... I saw it like paying my tax. I paid my tax to the story with the research, and that's what it's for.
Un autre aspect de l'univers de Planet Folk, c'est la démocratie sur, en utilisant les nouvelles technologies, les forums, les messages. Comment est venue l'idée de développer cet aspect qu'on peut peut-être aussi retrouver dans la nouvelle qu'on retrouve dans l'anthologie? Est-ce que ça a été quelque chose que vous avez voulu développer, qui est venu naturellement, d'où vient l'idée?
When I wrote Planet Fall, we were not in the horrific mess that we are in now. And so when I wrote Planet Fall, even when I wrote After Atlas, it was before Brexit. It was before Trump. And I was worried about very different things. But funny enough, I wasn't worried about democracy. I'm very worried about it now. But one of the things that I wanted to do in Planet Fall was to create a utopia. And with only 1,000 or so colonists, it still seemed plausible to me to have a democratic system in which everybody could actively participate. And so it was mostly just sitting down thinking, how would I do this? And so the use of technology is in that context is what I mean about playing with that intersection between technology and people, that on that colony, the technology facilitates democracy and aids democracy because it facilitates the conversation that needs to happen within the colony to have good democracy, sharing information, accurate information, and then enabling everybody, empowering everybody to make good decisions. It's totally different in After Atlas, which is set in Earth. very, very different. And I do talk about the collapse of democracy, which happens in the 2030s, which is the backstory for that book. And that, again, was before, when I was writing that, I was worried about TTIP, I think the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. I was very worried about that. And that was the seed that I grew Future Earth from. I'm very angry and very worried about things. So I wanted to make a place that said, yes, this is how you could do it. This is a way that we could use technology to have good democracy.
Est-ce que le personnage, au sein de cette démocratie, il y a toujours un monsieur loyal, Mac en l'occurrence dans votre roman, comment vous l'avez créé, comment on crée ce genre de leader politique qui maintient une colonie sous grâce à un secret qui... est-ce que ça a été dur? Est-ce que écrire un antagoniste qui n'en est pas vraiment un, mais qui a soit sa chape de plomb sur une colonie, ça a été difficile ou est-ce que... ou ça a été plutôt facile?
That was something that arose out of my frustration with modern-day politics, in that it seems to me that a lot of the people who should be making the decisions, the scientists, the artists, the teachers, the engineers, the real people who form the fabric of society, we don't tend to see them in politics. We see lawyers. I don't know if it's the same situation in France, but definitely in the UK and in the US, the proportion of lawyers and out of politicians is really disproportionate to the proportion of lawyers in real society. And one of the things I was thinking about was that if I decided today I'm going to go into politics, I wouldn't last 5 minutes. I think anybody who has any kind of anxiety disorder would just die immediately. But also that I just don't have that kind of personality. I don't have that mind. And so Mac, that character in the book, is someone I was thinking it would be realistic that if you were a scientist, as was the person who founded the colony and had this, you know, she became this super genius that was Wren's best friend, that she wouldn't be able to handle the machinery that goes around a project of that scale, building a spaceship to go and find God. That is not something that can be sold to the masses by someone who is working out how to build the engines on that ship. They are fundamentally different skill sets. And also, I was a teacher for several years, and one of the things that I found really fascinating about schools is the way that so much of the management structure in schools is founded on the basis of having somebody who is an excellent teacher, and then they get promoted into management, and they're not necessarily an excellent manager. They're totally different skill sets. And so I thought it would be plausible to have somebody. And of course, as soon as you create a person who is good at orchestrating the media message and fundraising, they have to have one foot in a very dirty pool, as far as I'm concerned. It is not a fair and just world when it comes to that amount of money and the manipulation of the media. And so he kind of organically grew out of what I would think would be the best kind of person for that job.
Un autre personnage qui est en filigrane dans le livre, c'est l'éclaireuse, qui est un personnage qui est en sous-texte dans quasiment tous les chapitres, sur lequel on base une mémoire, on base un culte. L'importance d'avoir une sorte de messie à la recherche de Dieu, est-ce que c'était une figure importante? Comment on construit toute une colonie sur le souvenir?
Yeah, so the colony itself, the book starts 20 years after the colony was founded. And it was founded by a woman called Li Sumi, and they call her the Pathfinder. And she basically eats a very strange seed and falls into a coma for 3 months. This is all in the backstory. And then wakes up with this absolutely crystal clear vision of there being a place that humanity can go to find God, and she knows the coordinates, and they see. She wakes up writing them down, and they see that there is a planet there, and that is what has led to everybody being in this place. And I was thinking about the plausibility. Her brain is fundamentally changed by the experience, and I was thinking, you know, you would need to have a radical leap forwards in technology for it to be plausible for people to do this within one lifetime. They're on the ship for 20 years. There has to be really, really serious advancements in technology to take people interstellar distances within 20 years. So there was an element of needing to craft something that would make the narrative work. And I really wanted to have a sort of messianic figure who was a scientist and who is not Caucasian. She's of Korean heritage. And that was really important to me because the constant whitewashing of Jesus really winds me up. And so I wanted to say, yes, look, this is not all kind of white Western. The whole thing of having somebody who has enough personality to do that. I'm fascinated by cult leaders, and in fact, there's the whole storyline of After Atlas revolves around the murder of a cult leader. These people who are so charismatic, and so clever and so socially able to persuade people to go and live in these remote places and then kill themselves, often in many cases, really fascinates me. And so she needed to be remarkable. She needed to be somebody who could persuade 1,000 people to get on an untested spacecraft and go somewhere that no one has ever been before. And she's totally open about why she's doing it. And that in turn made it really interesting to think about the colonists, because then you think, what kind of person would take such a risk? And there is always an element of that for any astronaut. You know, there is a huge amount. There are so many things that can go wrong in space travel. As an anxious person, I can sit there and think, my God, I can see all of the ways it could go wrong. I'd never be able to do that. So there is an element that they have that characteristic already. But somebody who does it with a religious reason as well, that really fascinated me. So yes, that the Pathfinder figure is someone who dominates the book and who is so important to Ren. And then you say about building a colony on memory. I've always been endlessly fascinated by all of the rituals and traditions of modern life. And we say amongst my friends, if we've done it three times, it's a tradition. And so we sometimes deliberately try and do silly things three times when we meet up so that it then becomes a tradition. And that we have so many social structures within society that come from the most kind of crazy places, some of them, and interesting places, that I thought it's not implausible to have a colony that does things to reinforce ritual, to knit a community together. You know, there are so many things that frustrate me as a parent, like we have to go and do this again this year, that we have to go and do this thing at school again. But I've seen the importance of it in terms of community and shared experience that I wanted to explore that in the book as well.
En parlant de communauté, à côté de tes activités, de vos activités d'écriture, vous animez un podcast avec des auteurs de science-fiction, qui a gagné d'ailleurs un prix Hugo pour le meilleur fancast cette année. Comment on produit ce genre de choses? Comment on se dit on va créer quelque chose pour la communauté, qui parle de la communauté avec des acteurs de la communauté? Comment ça se passe?
That again came from an angry place, unsurprisingly. There's a theme. Years ago, I was traveling back from Worldcon in America, and I heard a statistic, and I can't remember where I got it from. That's like the modern age. We're just left with these floating bits of information. We can't remember where we saw them, but it said that 17% of the voices in podcasting were female. How they got their sample, I don't know. As a good scientist, I have to say, I don't know whether it was accurate, but one of the things about that 17% really resonated with me, because that 17% comes up again and again and again. The number of female CEOs, the number of women in the average crowd scene in a Hollywood movie is 17%. The Gina Davis Institute does some really excellent research. And this 17% kept popping up again and again, and I thought, damn it. We've got this new thing, this new area that's really exciting, podcasting. Am I going to see the same rubbish there as I see everywhere else? So I was thinking about this and I thought, oh, I suppose one of the best ways to make sure that there are more female voices in podcasting is to have one of those be my voice. And I tried to avoid that for some time, and then I thought, no, I'm going to do this. So I brainstormed it with my husband and looked at lots of the podcasts that already exist, and there are so many fiercely intelligent, in-depth conversations happening in SFF podcasting. And I thought, what can I add to that? That, you know, everybody is already doing this, but there was one thing that I felt was missing, and that was silliness. And it was whimsy and something light. And so we created Tea and Jeopardy to be like the comic relief of, at its heart, it has an interview with a creative person. And we have artists, we have writers, screenwriters. The thing they have to do is to create something themselves. And then around it, we have this whole kind of audio theater device where there's an imaginary butler called Latimer, who was played by my husband, and the butler always tries to kill the guest at the end of each episode. And that came about because there's a phrase on the back of DVD cases which says, "Warning, may contain mild peril." And it always makes me laugh. It's like, what is mild peril, and why should I be concerned about this? And so we decided to put mild peril into our podcast. So when we have a guest come onto the show, we will send them an email beforehand telling them where the tea layer is, in a different tea layer every time, where they're going to be and how the butler is going to try to kill them. And then they come up with the solution. And then we write it as an audio drama. So yeah, it's very silly. It has chickens that sing and, you know, a murderous butler, and it's not supposed to be serious. But some of the conversations in the middle of all of that can be very serious. And And the people, one of the things I love most about it is that I get to talk to really interesting, creative people, and they have some great things to say.
Et combien de temps vous prenons pour l'écriture d'un épisode pour aboutir de quelque chose de concret?
Yeah, I think from first work to putting it online, it's about 3 days. Because we have email communication. We have to think of a different tea layer. We've had 69 episodes now, I think, and each one is in a different location, and there's a different peril. So there is always a part where Pete and I will be sitting there going, oh, where can we put it? Where could it? What about this? No, we've had one of those. What about this? No, that's like that one. Have we had something by the sea? Yeah, we had something by the sea 2 episodes ago. So you have to keep thinking of new places. Then there's the actual interview itself, and then I do all of the audio engineering, and that always takes 3 times longer than you think it ever will. It's just like a rule. However long that interview is, it will take 3 times the length of that raw file to be able to make it into something that's good. And then depending on what the peril is at the end, there may be really difficult sound effects to find, and sometimes I will have to think of a way to make it myself. And sometimes it's a matter of trying to find the best way to represent something. So what's a good example of that? So there was an episode with Adrian Tchaikovsky, which is on a pirate ship, and at the end the pirates discover that we're not pirates, and they tried to kill us and so that they can have their ship back. And Adrian's solution to this was to summon a wall of crabs, because it's Adrian and he likes weird creatures and things. So I was looking at the script and thinking, how am I going to make the sound of a crabby wall of death? And looking on sound effect websites that I use, it's like, no, there's no crabby wall of death here. So I was thinking, okay, then there's the sound of like crustaceans on wood. And in the end, I used one of those rainmaker tubes, which have got all of the beads inside, and layered 3 or 4 times this sound. And then it sounds like lots and lots of crabs scuttling around on a deck, because you paint the picture in the mind of the listener. But it took hours for me to figure that out, because I didn't know what sound effect to look for. So it can take a long time.
Et quel est votre épisode préféré, justement, en termes de production, votre meilleur souvenir?
We've done some live shows, and they're not strictly speaking the podcast, but this summer we did a live version of Tea and Jeopardy with George Really Really Martin. We call him George Really Really Martin now, and we did that in a joke a year ago when we won the Alfie, and then he became my editor this year, because I'm a wild cards writer, and I knew he was going to be in Helsinki, and I said, you know, would you like to come and do Tea and Jeopardy? And is it okay if we call you George Really Really Martin in the show? And thank goodness he said yes. And then throughout the rest of Worldcon, we heard people saying George Really Really Martin, and it made me so happy. So that is one of the happiest things that Tea and Jeopardy has given me, is that people are starting to call him George Really Really Martin. I don't know, to be honest. One of the other lovely things, I interviewed Pat Rothfuss a couple of years ago, and he was talking about his World Builders project. And we did a tea, and we joined in on one of his campaigns and raised money for charity with Tea and Jeopardy t-shirts. And that was really fun. There are all kinds of moments. Gail Carriger, I'm a huge fan of Gail Carriger. And I was at a convention a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, and she was at the same convention. And to give you context, way before I had my first publishing deal, I took all of her books to a convention in the UK and asked her very nicely to sign them for me, and she did, and I was very fangirlish. And then 2 to 3 years later, she saw me in the lobby and said, Emma Newman, Tea and Jeopardy, I love your show. And I died. I just died. I was the colour of this stage. And I had a panel afterwards. I was literally on the way to the panel, and I arrived at this panel going, Gail Carriger likes Tea and Jeopardy. And everyone was like, yay! And I was very excited. So, yeah, fangirl moments. And then she came on the show, and Yeah, that was really great. So I'm mostly just a fangirl who gets a chance to interview all of my favorite people.
Un autre de vos hobbies, de vos passions, c'est le jeu de rôle et le jeu. Est-ce que ça influence beaucoup votre écriture? Est-ce que c'est important pour vous, la pratique ludique? Je rappelle pour les spectateurs que les Utopiales sont aussi un festival de jeux qui a lieu juste au sous-sol. Est-ce que c'est important pour vous?
Role-playing is my favorite thing to do any moment I can, and I love tabletop. I'm playing in two D&D games at the moment, and we're about to start a 7th C game. And I also love LARP, live-action role-playing, and there's a game that I'm playing in the UK at the moment called Empire, which has about 2,000 players, and we all descend on a field in the middle of nowhere 4 times a year and create this tent city, and it's just the best thing. I love it. I love role-playing so much. And I think it has had a huge influence on me as a writer, because there was about 10 years in between when I was 17 and 27 when I did not write, and there's a whole story to do with that. But I ran a lot of role-playing games, and that was where I did my storytelling. And being the GM of a game gives you a really intense grounding in world building, and also how to start a story and how to hook people into a story, how to make your players engage with the world. What do you show them of the world? What makes a good story? How does the story that you develop as a GM interact with the stories of each of the characters? So it gives you an appreciation of character arc and narrative arc. And as a player, it's such a rich, fertile ground for experiencing different points of view and having characters who are very, very different to me. And I'm one of those role players that really gets in, like, really intensely into character. And so I feel like I've lived about 50 lives, and I'm not joking. I feel like I have experienced things on an emotional level that I would never be able to experience. And I find real life fundamentally boring. And I think that's one of the reasons I love science fiction so much, is because I can't read most contemporary lit, because it's just, well, I can go and sit by a window and think about conversations I didn't have with my father for 300 pages and then decide that life is terrible. I can do that in the real world. I want to go and do other things, and it's the same with role playing. You can go and have all of those other experiences. So there are so many of my friends that I've met as authors in my professional circles who were also and are also GMs. And there's a reason for that correlation. You know, we love story. We want to live and breathe narrative, and role-playing is one of the best ways to do that.
Il reste 10 minutes, juste le temps pour vous. Si vous voulez poser des questions, on vous laisse la parole. N'hésitez pas à lever la main pour vous signaler.
This isn't a strictly sci-fi related question, I apologize. You mentioned writing for the Baker Street anthology. And my question is about an issue that arises with anthologies where the stories happen chronologically, they all exist in the same canon, have some of the same characters. And there was something jarring that I noticed something in Monstrous Little Voices. Between the way in the first story by Foz Meadows, the character of Prospero was portrayed as someone predatory and sort of irredeemable. And whereas The Unkindness Cut framed him more as kind of a chaotic, neutral curmudgeon in a way. And my story is, how do you coordinate around writing in the same universe in such a compressed format where you have to express your ideas very concisely, very quickly?
Well, I can answer that question. We didn't. In Monstrous Little Voices, we had a common plot element of the knife that we were briefed to include, but we could do whatever we wanted with the characters. So you describe a potential flaw with that approach. We all have different visions of different characters that we want to do, and in terms of the editor, they make a decision about how much they want to smooth those characters across the different stories. So that wasn't something that was flagged up to us as writers at the time. But it varies depending on the anthology. So for example, Wildcards, which is a universe, superheroes universe, which has existed for 30 years now, has 23, I think, different editions, books, mosaic novels in that world. That is handled very, very differently. And so with that, you have George and Melinda, who are the editors, and they keep a very, very tight rein on how all of the characters fit together. But also, if you are writing a story in which somebody else's character appears, you have to go and talk to the writer of that character and approve with them any conversations that your own character has with theirs to remove this issue. So it's all to do with, in my opinion, the attitude of the editor and what they are trying to create. With Monstrous Little Voices, I didn't have the impression when we were creating the stories that Dave wanted to have a cohesive universe where the emphasis was on those same characters, that same cast of characters appearing in different places. It was more, pick something you want to have fun with in the Shakespearean world and go and have fun with it. So it depends on the editorial tone and the editorial, the remit of the editor on how those elements are handled.
Est-ce qu'il y a une autre question? Moi, j'en ai une. Quels sont vos...
Si quelqu'un veut commencer à découvrir votre travail, vous lui conseillerez de quelle lecture en premier?
Well, conveniently, there's one in this, so you can always start with that one. That's the one from the Baker Street anthology. I won the British Fantasy Society Best Short Story Award for that story in 2015. As for novels, it depends on the kind of thing that you like as a reader. If you're a science fiction fan, then I would say either Planetfall or After Atlas. After Atlas is going to be translated into French, but I don't know when the release date is, and Planetfall has already been released in France. If you enjoy fantasy, and if you don't mind reading in English, there's the Split World series. If you like historical fantasy, there's Brothers Ruin. There are two novellas in it's the Industrial Magic series, and that's set in 1850s London and Manchester, and that's a Victorian England where the Industrial Revolution was caused by advances in magic instead of advances in science, and so it's kind of almost an alternative history. So I'd like to think that there's a little bit for lots of different kinds of people. It just depends on what you like first. The Split Worlds novels are very different to my science fiction. They are written in a very different style. So if any of you read Planetfall and think, oh, I'll go and read Between Two Thorns, which is the first fantasy, it's written completely differently. So don't expect the same thing between genres.
Il me restait une dernière question. Quels sont tes projets d'écriture, tes prochains projets d'écriture, de jeux de rôle, de podcast?
I won't bore everyone with my current projects and role-playing because that's one of the things that I have to make sure that I don't do all the time is to bore people with the thrilling things that my characters have been doing that only I will find thrilling. So my next projects, I have a third science fiction novel coming out in April next year, which is in the Planetfall universe. Planetfall is set on a distant colony. After Atlas is set on Earth. And the next one, Before Mars, is set on Mars. It's not an ironic title. I've just finished that one. And I have a fourth one, which will be the next novel that I'm writing. I'm currently writing a novelette commissioned by the same editor as the Sherlock Holmes story, and the idea for this one is it's all Frankenstein's monster, which is all I'm going to say, and I'm having a great deal of fun writing that at the moment. And I'm also working on something which is not science fiction or fantasy, which is a very odd experience for me, and I have to keep stopping myself from like adding in just a little bit of science fiction. It's like, no, I'm trying to do this. I'm going to see if I can actually do this. But that's all I'll say about it. One of the things, as a rule, I never talk about in detail what I'm writing about, because I feel like I lose the energy, the excitement that I have for that project if I talk about it, because my brain thinks it's told the story and I have to hold that for the page. So that's what's going on at the moment.
Presque 11h, on va s'arrêter là pour cet échange. Vous pourrez retrouver Emma Newman pendant tout le festival, mais aussi en dédicace à la librairie. On vous remercie d'être venus aussi nombreux pour cet échange et on vous souhaite une bonne journée.